Welcome to The Unconventional Path, entrepreneurship and innovation stories and ideas. Hello, I'm Bala Musitz.
And I'm Mike Wasserman.
Today, we're excited to be joined by Yael Yofi. Yael is a serial entrepreneur and the founder of her current business, 3X4 Genetics, which is a nutrigenics company that launched in 2018. 3X4 Genetics does genetic testing and focuses on genetic aspects of diet, exercise, lifestyle, and health. Yael has co-authored two books on genetics and is also an adjunct professor at Rutgers University. Yael joined me from her home in South Africa.
And Bela, I know our listeners are sharp-eared often, and they will hear a beeping in the background. And this is her uninterruptible power supply, and it activated when her power went out at the very beginning of the interview. So I think, Bela, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is our first interview which occurred during a power outage. But it was amazing. So couldn't tell. She went on like somebody who's used to this happening, which in South Africa, the power does go out with some regularity. But what an interesting guest. The genetic testing industry is a fast-growing space. People know about it in the U.S., I know, with all these different home tests that people are putting out and kind of the buzz that's generated on social media. But linking genetics to health can be a really important tool for people. Especially here in Germany, the data privacy and security issues are a big deal. So at least my friends here in Germany are much more cautious about jumping on this bandwagon than my friends and family in the U.S. But it's a fascinating kind of, I think, approach to what she's taking to this space. So I'm really excited to hear your conversation with Yael. Let's jump right into the interview.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Hello. I was just realizing that it's Skype, so I just needed to get organized.
Okay.
I'm good. We are expecting a power cut, but I have a backup.
Okay.
We might. Just if it does happen, we might just lose power for a changeover moment. Just to let you.
Thank you. Thank you for the warning.
Let's hope it doesn't happen, but it can.
Yeah.
I've been having a lot of fun.
So you're in South Africa.
Yeah.
So is a power disruption, a cut, a normal thing?
Very normal. We have major problems with our. With our service provider, a government organization that delivers electricity, and they've made a real right mess of it. So we are very often running out of power. So what they do is they have this thing called load shedding, where they shut down our electricity for a couple of hours a day, or a couple of hours a day, twice a day, to conserve how much electricity is being generated. It's real fun and games, yeah.
Yeah, because there's a finite amount of electricity. And every once in a while that happens here in the United States, typically on a very, very hot summer day when there's a huge demand for air conditioning and they start load sharing various different things. But yeah.
So it happens in winter when there's a lot of heaters. It happens, but mostly it happens when the power stations break, which happens quite often.
Mm.
Their maintenance has been terrible for the last couple of years. So often the power stations will break and they just don't have backup to be able to provide the power. So then we go into it. So actually it started. So we're fine. We're up and running. There might be a little beep in the background. I don't know if you can hear it.
I do not.
It's my UPS providing Wi-Fi while we're under power. So hope that's okay.
Wow. We're pretty sophisticated. This is probably the most sophisticated connection I've had in all my podcasts.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah. So welcome to the podcast. And help me pronounce your name.
It's Yael.
Yael. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Very good. So you are the founder and chief scientist of, is it 3X4 Genetics?
That's right. 3X4 Genetics. You got it right. Most people say 3x4, but it is actually 3X4.
And is there a meaning to that name?
Yes, there is. It's actually, so I had an education company before 3X4, and it's the framework we built to teach genetics, 3X4. It's the way we actually teach our practitioners, and it's also the way our reports look. And so we named the company after that.
Ah, very nice. And when did you start the company?
So this company, okay, well, is we started, we launched 3 years ago. But of course, as with any startup, there's a couple of years of work that go in before that. So it's probably been about 5 years of work, about 2 years of finding investors and angel investors and building a product, but 3 years that we've been launched in the market and 1 year in the USA.
Yeah, yeah. And so what's the product or service the company provides?
So it's basically a genetic test, but it's a little bit more than that. So you do a cheek swab, you know, you get a kid and you do a cheek swab, but we're very focused on diet, lifestyle, environment. So how do I understand myself? How do I look at my genes to be able to understand who I am, to be able to get better recommendations for what do I eat, what kind of exercise I do, how I live? So it's really that kind of genetics, really health genetics.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've heard of similar things with, for example, for cancer treatments, they do some genetic analysis and then based on your genetics, they can tailor a particular cancer treatment because they think it's going to be more efficacious for you. So this is similar to that, but in essence, taking a proactive view of your health and saying that these are the things that you should be doing to improve your health based on your genetics. Did I get that right?
So you're right in that the cancer genetic tests that you refer to are really excellent. And what they basically do is they are quite different in that what they do is they look at the cancer tumor. They type it, which means they kind of analyze it, sequence it. And by understanding the genetics of that tumor, they can work out what the right chemotherapy treatment is to you. So that has been amazing. One of the great things that have come out of genetics. Ours is a little bit different. We're actually looking for genetic variation. So why are we different from each other? So we have this like code in our body, the sequence in our body that makes us different. And if we are able to analyze that and understand that difference, which we refer to as genetic variation, which is really just differences in our sequence code, it gives us insights into how we respond differently. So I suppose you could say like how a tumor responds to drugs would be the same thing as how do we respond to food? How do we respond to exercise? How do we respond to toxins in a world? It's a little bit different, but the principle is the same, which is how do we respond different to our world around us? And therefore, what is the right lifestyle and diet and world that we should construct around us to obviously, but it's not just for healthy people. We obviously do a lot with, some people want to prevent disease, but a lot of disease management. So a lot of people who've been trying to find answers for a long time.
Sure.
And haven't. Yeah.
So is this something that I, as an individual, can order and try and send off and I get back an analysis, or is it something I need to do in partnership with a physician?
Yeah. So in 3x4, it's with a physician, with a practitioner. There are many, many genetic testing companies in the marketplace where you can buy it online and get it delivered and you can do 23andMe. This is not that. So we work with a group of practitioners in the US who are multidisciplinary. So it could be a chiropractor, it could be a dentist, it could be a naturopath, a doctor, a dietitian, but they are a health practitioner who's been trained in genetics. So they go through a lot of training with us. They go through a mentorship program. They're part of a community support. The reason being that one of the things to understand is that genetics does not define who we are alone. So genetics is a huge part of who we are, huge part, but it's not everything, because every decision we make, everything we do, every exposure we have is going to also determine how healthy we are, how we can prevent disease. So for us, genetics is a huge piece of a puzzle, but it's still part of a puzzle. And so you need a practitioner who's trained in that kind of puzzle stuff, right? Who are you? What are the pieces of your puzzle? Where did you come from? And they put in genetics into that, to that kind of mystery solving. And then they look at you and say, okay, I know who you are now. Let's figure out how I'm going to help you. And so the problem with direct consumer is they have this false promise that genetics gives answers without consideration of who you are. And of course, that's just completely underwhelming and really doesn't kind of deliver what genetics is supposed to.
Yeah, yeah, very nice. So I think back on, 20 years ago, the drug companies, pharmaceutical companies, did all of their advertising and promotion to physicians. They educated the physicians. And then they soon figured out that if they educated the public as well, then the public will go into the physician asking for a particular product or pharmaceutical product. So you have this similar challenge, right? So yes. You have to sort of educate physicians because they have to be knowledgeable. But at the same time, you know, it's also good if consumers pull. How do you do that? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that is the great challenge, especially of a company which is focused on educating and training and working with practitioners, is how do we educate the consumer to be able to always say, like, the most important thing is teach the consumer to ask the right questions. So don't give them the answers, but teach. So there are so many genetic testing companies in the market. There is so much genetics in the media, whether it's Time or CNN. So how does a consumer who doesn't have my training be able to choose the right genetic testing company, which will give them the answers that they truly need or be meaningful? So we do it, you know, in a couple of ways. So we have a website, obviously, where we're going to be building out a lot more of Q&A around what are those questions. So we're actually in the process now of building out, like, what are the top 100 questions I've been answering for the last 20 years? It's always the same question. So if we can actually answer them and put them out, then we can, and it's not necessarily about 3x4, but it's about, you know, what kind of privacy should I ask for from a genetic testing company? Should they destroy my DNA? Like, what is MTHFR and does it count? Should I take supplements based on my DNA? These are questions that I've been asked for 20 years, and they're the same ones. They haven't changed. So what we're trying to do is to kind of capture that and share it so that when an individual is making a genetics decision, because ultimately everyone's going to know their genes. Everyone's going to know their genes in the future. How do they make the best possible decision? So that is definitely one of our challenges. Social media education, website education, a lot of blogging, of trying to reach the consumer around a Q&A. And then also training our practitioners to make sure that they've got the answers when they're having conversations with their patients, that they've got the right wording, that they're not speaking science, that they're actually speaking consumer.
Yes, yes. So is this product or service regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, for example, in the United States and other regulatory agencies around the world?
No. So it's actually not regulated by the FDA. And one of the reasons being is that what we are recommending is diet and lifestyle changes. So if we were what they call a pharmacogenomics test, which is where you make recommendations for drugs, we are definitely in the FDA zone. So we have intentionally stayed in the place, obviously, where my expertise is, but also where we really want to be, which is how do we get people to make better daily decisions every day? When you start getting into drug genetics or medical genetics, then it becomes an FDA conversation. So what happened with 23andMe, where they started telling people what their breast cancer risk was, they definitely become an FDA conversation. So for us, we do not talk about risk. We don't even use the word risk. We talk about how do your genes impact the way your body works? Why don't we do that? So we don't calculate risk. We don't talk about disease. We'll leave that to the other guys. For us, we really want to focus on what is the stuff that you can do, that you can make decisions about, that you don't need a doctor to, like, prescribe for you on a prescription pad, that can actually change your life for the better.
Yeah. Now let's talk a little bit about the business. You started this a number of years ago, and is it venture funded? This sounds like a relatively expensive business to sort of get started, and with long sales cycles, long education cycles before sort of the revenue starts flowing, right?
Yeah. So this is my third genetics company that I've been a part of as a startup founder, and I built an education company which I was totally out of genetic testing for a long time. I was a little bit burnt out, disappointed, disillusioned. And then I also started a clinic where we wanted to see whether running a genetics clinic, a nutrigenomics clinic, would really deliver if we were really focused and we were using the best practitioners. And in all of this education and clinic, I realized that there really wasn't a genetic testing company in the marketplace that had solved any of the problems that I had had in my first company, my second company, my third company. And I realized that I had been very much part of the problem and not the solution, that genetics actually hadn't evolved in 17 years, that the kind of test I was working with in 2017 was the same, very similar to what I'd been working with in the year 2000. So I really came to the point where it wasn't what I really wanted to start another company, but I realized that there really wasn't anything in the marketplace that I could even use in my clinic that I thought was good enough or that had solved not only practitioners' needs, but also solved the consumer need. And so I went on a little bit of a pilgrimage to try and see what it was that I'd been doing wrong all these years, but also what the answers were. And I didn't actually know what the answer was. I just knew what the problem was. And I went to a whole lot of really interesting conferences. One of my favorite is Exponential Medicine. I don't know if you've heard about it, but it's part of the Exponential, a bunch of Peter Diamandis, and they run a conference in San Diego at the end of every year, which is called Exponential Medicine, which is really the most cutting edge science and medicine and health companies in the world that are really looking to the future. And I took myself off there. It was a bit of a bucket list, could barely afford to stay at the hotel. I had to stay at like a little budget place down the road and kind of walk there every morning. And I really found a lot of the inspiration that I was looking for, which was that science wasn't going to solve the problem. That I had been trying to solve the problem with science for 20 years, but actually that's not where the solution went. And the solution there was technology and design. And so I realized I knew nothing about technology and design. And so I started looking for a partner who'd be able to take genetics, which in its worst form is really just data. It's just A, T's and G's and C's, and be able to make something out of it that would be meaningful or valuable to a practitioner and a consumer. And I found this extraordinary little, well, it wasn't such a little company, but I found this extraordinary company down the road from my office called Sea Monster, and they were a gamification company. And they build games, but they build games based on behavioral economics. So how do I get people to change their behavior using gamification? And I kind of knocked on the door and said, you know, I want to build a genetic test based on your principles. And they were like, here's a glass of water. You can like sit on a couch, you know, I've got a glass of water on the couch in the entrance hall. And then I got chatting to them and I was like, no, we can take genetics and we can make it interactive and we can, you know, bring the, and suddenly they were like, oh, this sounds interesting. They took me to the conference room. They gave me a cup of coffee and the conversation really began. And their chief technology officer was Jason Haddock. And he has a long history in design thinking, as well as user experience, patient, you know, consumer centric experience. And he just really got what I was saying, which is, you know, I've got all the science, but it's not working. And so Jason and I started this idea of trying to build a company. And he had a full-time job with Sea Monster. So Sea Monster and I built a partnership and we decided to try and build this kind of MVP of what it could look like. And, the short story is that Jason left, Sea Monster. And I set up 3X4 Genetics. Jason left as their CTO and joined me. And the two of us built out this MVP product where we used all his background of design thinking, design, user experience, color, visual, and my background of science. And that's how actually 3X4 got to. And oh, that wasn't the question you asked me at all. The question was, how did I find an investor?
Yeah, but that's okay. That story was important in the journey. That's good. Yeah.
Now I can tell you how I found an investor. So we spent 2 years trying to find an investor and understand that in South Africa, there's a very small investor pool, very, very small, particularly for these kind of biotech kind of health tech companies. So we really, really battled. Jason and I, we traveled to the US quite a few times. We came very close. You know how it is, 11 and a half hour. and just couldn't. I really set myself a goal of 2 years that if I couldn't find funding to build this company, then, you know, I would go back to doing consulting and education and all the other things I was doing. And I had like a month left. I know this sounds like a cliche, but this is entirely true. And I had just gone back from San Francisco and I was invited to go to friends for dinner. Friends that I've known for a very long time. And I kept on saying no because I was too tired to go for dinner. But I thought I can't say no again, so I'm going to go. So I go and it's Friday night and they have some friends there who are lawyers. And they sit and they're like interrogating me. What do you do? What do you do? You know what? Like, and I've just come back from an American trip. I'm exhausted. I'm jet lagged. I've got no sense of humor, but they just keep on asking me anyway. But it's actually my friends. So Jared Khan had a clothing retail company that had done really well and he'd sold it. While I'd been busy trying to fund this company and he had put the money into a fund and he now had decided he was going to invest in a couple of startups. So he's like, I didn't know that you were doing that. And I'm like, well, yeah, I've been trying to do this for 2 years. I was like, well, I didn't know that you had sold and had some money anyway. But, you know, and he said to me, well, you know, maybe I'd be interested in investing. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Heard that a million times, you know. Anyway, that was Friday night. Monday morning, he phoned me and he said, let's have coffee. And we had coffee every single day for a week. And that was the first week of December. And by January, we were funded.
Oh, wow. Wow. So it's more like, at least here in the United States, we call that more like an angel investor.
He was an angel. I call him my double angel because he was an extraordinary. So he was totally angel funding, but it enabled us to build our first product. So up until that point, we had no product and only we had an idea. And Jared's angel funding helped us actually build the product.
Yeah.
Then once we had a product, which we launched in South Africa, and got some traction and some sales and some practitioners. Then we started looking for a US investor. And so we didn't think we were ready for the US. I went to a conference. I took some sample reports with me, got chatting to someone while I was drinking, making myself some tea at a conference. It always happens. Everything great that's happened to me has happened when I'm making tea, not coffee, tea, tea. At a conference. And I met this extraordinary woman, Ruth Westreich, who runs a foundation in the US. And the money in the foundation goes into health and functional medicine, kind of very much our space. And we were talking about how the genetic industry was really in a terrible way and that there wasn't really any good companies in the marketplace. And she felt quite strongly about it. So I was telling her about what we were doing differently. I showed her. And it just so happened I was actually speaking at a conference the next week. So she said, I'm coming to hear you speak. And she said, I'm bringing my wealth manager on her private jet. And she did. She came and she said, keep lunch open. And she came and she heard me speak. And in fact, my whole talk was about why the genetic testing industry has failed, which was the perfect talk for them. And she brought her wealth manager. Who runs a fund, a venture fund in out of Seattle. They're a family office and they managed all her money. So she's like, I'm introducing you. It's up to you. You know, yes. I've introduced 10 companies. He's never invested in one, but I'll introduce you. And so I got to meet Tony and we had lunch together and he said, how much money do you want? I said, I have absolutely no idea because in fact, I didn't come to the US to find money. I came here to speak at a conference anyway. And the relationship started and I went back to Jason. I said, you know what? We really should be going to the US. They don't have anything there. And whether we think it's ready or not, they think we're ready. And so that's how it happened. Actually, we went back to Seattle, had lots and lots of meetings with Tony and he became our Series A investor and he's actually still our investor. And has stayed with us and will until Series B, which will be towards the end of the year.
Oh, very good. Very good. Now, how has this COVID crisis impacted your business?
Yes. So we launched in the USA in February 2020, which is possibly the worst month in the last 24 months to launch a startup into the government. So so it had a huge impact. So we basically launched. There was great excitement. We started seeing sales come up in the first month. And the second month, we went to zero, but literally zero.
Yeah.
So we obviously had a whole lot of sales projections for our tranches of funding, and we had nothing. So I will never forget that board meeting. It was in end of March 2020. So when all the countries went into lockdown.
Sure. Yeah.
What we discovered is that most health professionals do not know how to do telehealth. They barely know how to use Skype. They were completely, completely caught off guard. There were a few practitioners who had been doing telehealth, and they just flew. They just did brilliantly. But I think 90% of health professionals did not know what to do. They're not trained in technology. They're not even trained in business practice. So they certainly weren't trained in technology.
Sure. Yeah.
Or how to market yourself digitally, you know, and not sit in an office and wait for patients to come to you. So there was a huge crisis in the general healthcare and definitely with our practitioners. So as I said, we had a very interesting board meeting a month into COVID lockdown, where it could have gone either way. And we were extremely lucky. We've got an amazing investor. And he just said, you know, I believe in you guys. What is your plan for 2020?
Yeah.
Because it's not going to be sales. So what are you going to deliver at the end of 2020 that would have made my investment worthwhile? And so we went into a huge R&D phase. And decided to build stuff. We have a lot of technology. We're a very tech company. So we decided to build a lot of stuff so that when COVID started coming out, we would be in a better position and upgrade a product. So we had to go from an MVP to a kind of a mature product, but also all our systems and our journey and our user experience and everything. So he stuck by us during the first year, which was absolutely extraordinary. It also did help that we were 90% of our staff were based in South Africa, which has a fantastic currency. So if you fund it in dollars and you're paying your staff in South Africa, it's probably one of the greatest reasons we could survive 2020. And so a lot of genetic testing companies didn't survive. And we found, you know, when we came out the other side, that we were actually very strong in that we had built a lot of stuff. We had really got past that MVP phase. We had, we in fact ended up hiring some staff, which was quite extraordinary. And we were really ready to go come the end of 2020.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, if you think about the vast majority of companies that get funded by venture capital or even angel investors, family offices, they tend to be based in the United States. They tend to be run by either a 18-year-old male or a 40-year-old male, and you're from South Africa, you're a woman, you have this new product that people don't totally understand what it is. You know, those are huge challenges, and I'm sure there were more. So tell me about some of those challenges that you faced along the way.
Yeah, I mean, you're 100% right. So first thing, I mean, Tony has never funded any company that's not an American company. And in fact, it's extremely difficult to fund a South African company because of the IP. So the IP was sitting in South Africa, and South Africa government does not want IP to leave the country. So there was that against us, which was a really big deal. And that's why South African companies generally don't get funded internationally, is because the obstacles are so great that it's just not worth the effort when you've got so much talent in the US. That was challenge number one. The second challenge was there was absolutely no doubt that I am one of the few women who were out there looking for funding with a PhD in genetics and not an MBA in business. So not having and having no experience of trying to secure Series A funding, like none whatsoever. The only thing that worked in my favor a little bit is that I have been working in the US. In fact, I lived in Boulder, Colorado, in my first startup. And I was part of the first startup in the world who built the first nutrigenomic genetic test, which was this little company called Saona that came from UK and moved to Boulder. So I had some pedigree in startup genetic startups in the US. And I also had been teaching there at universities, and I had been working. So at least my name was known in the US. It wasn't completely like the South African scientist who no one knew. I had really been working in the US for 20 years and actually lived internationally for more time than I'd been in South Africa. So that was a help. But I have to say that the real advantage came from our angel investor, Jared Kahn, who really, really stood by us and by me. And he actually came in as CEO. So he actually has a day job. He was running another company, but he, when we set up 3x4 and before Jason moved over as from the gamification company, Jared actually came in as CEO with me, and I was awful at legal, financial, pretty much all those things, you know, and he stepped in to help me and said, right, let's get our contracting sorted. Let's get a really good accounting firm. Let's get a proper board pack together that we can take to an investor. And it was his idea. He said, we need Jason. He's got more experience in this stuff. So Jared and I brought Jason in, and then it was the three of us. And I think Jason and I used to start travel together. So we had Jason, who kind of speaks design, speaks product development, speaks sales, and had more experience in business as a business analyst, yeah. And myself with obviously the history. And the two of us together were a really good co-founder team. Who could then do a decent presentation. So, it was tough. It was really tough.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. What a challenge. Pretty impressive what you've accomplished. So what's in store for the next 12 months?
Well, hopefully I'll be moving to Seattle in the next 12 months. So my bags are packed and I'm waiting. So that's a really big part. So Jason and I both have had the full intention of moving to Seattle for the last year, and we'll get there. What we're looking to do in 2021, now that we have a little bit of traction and we got through the worst and we still have funding, is to really, we really believe that we can be the best practitioner-based genetic testing company in the US. We do not think that the market has really evolved in any way that has provided what we have. We just need to spend a year now getting into the market, which we weren't able to do during COVID last year. And we think that especially from the middle of 2021, we think it's going to open up significantly. So even things, you know, like I used to attend conferences every month and speaker conferences, and now everything's virtual, which has been extremely difficult for networking. So, you know, just being able to get back out there, being able to connect again, we really, looking to 2021 to get into the market. We're starting to also look at a lot of partnerships, which has been amazingly exciting, where they're starting to approach us instead of us trying to find them. So we're definitely seeing that our brand and our idea and our conversation is getting into the market, and 2021 is where we need to raise that up and really get a baseline, a strong baseline. And then we'll go into Series B, and then after Series B, we'll do a full expansion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, very nice. So we've been at this almost a half hour now, so I want to wrap up. You've been a wonderful guest. Is there anything I should have asked you that I haven't?
Wow, no. I mean, I got to talk about all this. I got to talk about how hard it's been. I got to talk about how exciting it is to bring a South African company. I think, yeah, I'll just say one thing, you know, that the South African USA story is, while however difficult it was, and we spent a lot of money in lawyers' fees trying to get the IP to move, it has actually, I think, been to our greatest advantage. And one of the reasons why is we were flying under the radar. So there's a lot of genetic businesses in the US, and they're all watching each other, and yeah, they all know yeah. who each other is. And while they were doing that, we have some extraordinary individuals working at 3x4 in South Africa, technology, design, science, clinical. And we were able to build out a really world-class product and test it in the South African market for 2 years before we took it to the US. So when it arrived in the US, it was already into its third year of maturity. And so I think that perhaps US investors should be a little bit more open-minded, because I think there's some real gems that aren't sitting in the US, and also that the value proposition of it, you know, that we're we were so much cheaper to get through the first couple of years than US companies. So I probably just want to leave it at that.
Yeah. Very good. Well, thank you very much. You've been a wonderful guest. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. And I wish you the best going forward.
Thank you. And thank you so much for inviting me. Really enjoyed it.
Certainly.
Bela, fascinating guest. So what struck you most about your conversation with Yael?
Yeah, I thought she was a really good guest. It was really interesting. You know, one of the things is this genetics testing is a really crowded market. And we've seen this in our other guests, too. Here's a great example of sort of carving out a niche, right? Figuring out some aspect of this growing industry that others are not addressing, and then going after that segment of a growing industry. And the nice thing about growing industries is that oftentimes your competition will leave you alone because they're busy, they're growing, they're happy, right? They're not fighting and trying to stay alive. They're all growing and enjoying life, so to speak. So if you can find a growing industry and find an aspect that's being ignored or a segment that's being ignored, and then build your business to address that segment, I think that's a great place to be. And I think that's one of the things that she's done. And the other thing that I found interesting was, at least here in the United States, there's lots of advertising about genetics and learning about your ancestry and where your family's from and your historic origins and all those types of things. But I think her niche here is a little bit different. It's about how can genetics help us live healthier lives? So it's sort of using it going forward as opposed to looking back. It's this notion of how can I take this information? I mean, we're all different, right? We know different cultures and different folks have different life expectancies. Some of that's due to, you know, culture and habit and the food they eat, but other parts of it are genetic. So how can we tailor the things that we do based upon our genetics? And I think that's a really interesting aspect of the conversation we had. And then the third thing that stuck out at me was how, you know, as with many businesses and many startups, the whole COVID thing and how it really threw her a curveball. And they were just getting ready to launch the United States. And now, boom, all of a sudden you can't travel, you can't do anything. And as she said, you know, this is also an interesting product because you have to sell it to doctors or medical professionals because they're the ones that sort of help the individual, the patient, I'll call them. It's not really a patient, but the individual understand all this stuff. But you also have to sort of market to the individual. So there's a two-pronged problem there. And she was saying that when COVID hit, all of the medical professionals were just trying to figure out how to run their own business. They were not interested in listening to pitches from companies about new products or new services. They were just trying to figure out, okay, patients used to come into my office. They can't do that anymore. Now, how am I going to see patients and help continue to help them and provide services for them? So it really changed her business model as well. So to me, those were the three big things that sort of stuck out at me. How about you, Mike?
Great points, Bela. A couple of kind of the angles that I really thought was interesting too in this was, you know, she's a serial entrepreneur, and it's a great story that she had about kind of learning from her previous startups and finding space in a busy market, and then going on and finding the right angel investors and how important that was. So I really thought that story of kind of leveraging her past experiences, successes and things that might not have been so successful, seeing how the market changed, like you said, and really digging into that opportunity and finding the right investors to help her bring it to the market. And then the second part is kind of bring a product into an international market. Here's somebody who developed the technology in South Africa. And this was fascinating about the intellectual property restrictions. And this is something I'm really interested in, is how do you get something from one market and start a new venture in another market, especially one in the US that's oftentimes a challenge to get into because you don't have the network, right? Now she had built a network up in as part of her kind of previous experience, which was really helpful. She was a known quantity. But I thought this was really cool. What do you think from your VC perspective? How do you see this story in terms of an international new venture? And, you know, she kind of raised the point that VCs might be missing out a little bit in funding non-US companies because of the unknowns and the uncertainty. You know, what do you think? Could VCs do better in this regard?
You know, it's been relatively recent, but it's probably been the last 10 years or so that many of the larger VC firms have set up international funds just for this purpose, because they've recognized that there are good investment opportunities in various different parts of the world. And, you know, one of the things you have to remember that in the United States, one of the reasons the venture capital business works so well is because of the tax structure here. And what I mean by that is if you're an investor in a venture capital fund, the money you make is treated as a long-term capital gain, which is taxed at like somewhere around 15 to 20%. Whereas ordinary income that you make is probably at if you have enough money to invest in a VC fund, you're probably being taxed at 35 or 40 or 45%. So there's a big tax advantage to investing in VC funds or private equity in general, not just VC funds, but private equity. And of course, you have to remember these investments are risky. It's not like putting your money in the bank. So, you know, you have this sort of risk adjusted return equation you got to sort of think about. But that makes investing in these private equity firms from an investor perspective very interesting. And so that's not true in other countries. So in other countries, the tax laws are different. So that's one thing that makes it a little more challenging. For a U.S.-based VC fund to set up a fund in a different country also has challenges with getting money in and out of various different countries and foreign investment, right? So various different nations have foreign investment rules and regulations, including the United States. You have to disclose if you make foreign investments here. So it becomes a little bit more complicated from the point of view of setting up these funds, but folks have figured out how to do it, and they're doing it quite successfully. Israel has a pretty big venture and healthy venture capital community. Other countries, China does. You know, as China was growing 10 years ago at phenomenal rates, there was several big VC funds set up, China branches, I'll call them, and to invest in Chinese companies. It gets a little more complicated, but it's being done. And I think that, and part of this is cultural too, right? In various different countries, the notion of starting your own business and taking that risk is accepted and sometimes applauded, and in other countries, less so culturally. So, you know, you have to bring that into the mix as well.
Yeah, Germany's in the latter group, Bela, definitely. And we've struggled here in Germany because the natural orientation of the culture is very risk averse. And things like going bankrupt, which are kind of part of standard operating procedure in the U.S. for entrepreneurs, right? And taking out big loans and maxing out your credit cards and all these things are just no-goes for the most part here in Germany. So you're absolutely right that the culture matters.
Yeah. Yeah. Culture is really important. Now, the other thing that's related to this is this notion of starting your business in one country and then expanding to other countries. And I want to talk about that for a second, because here, too, there's complications and there's things that you need to consider. For example, the medical device company that we started, we sold products and services in Germany and Japan and many other parts of Europe, and this is pre-European community. And so I remember in different countries, there were different ways of bringing products in. In some countries, you had to have a distributor. You had to find a local a company that's in that country, and you had to distribute your product through them, and you had to have a local partner on the ground. You could not really set up your own foreign division, I'll call it, in that country. You had to do it through a partner. In other countries, you can set up a foreign office of your company in that country and run it out of there. So you have to understand each country's laws and regulations. And this is where you have to have a good attorney. We also found, interestingly enough, I don't know if other countries do it, but the United States embassies were a big help for us. So we would go, almost every U.S. embassy has a business branch, I'll call it, for that country, where they're interested in helping U.S. companies do business in that country. So that we found was very helpful. So there are ways to do it. It adds a little complexity, but sometimes those are the big markets, right? They're the natural markets. So you got to do it. And as a company grows, you want to do it. So it's certainly doable. And I think it's actually in some countries, it's getting easier. And in other countries, it's getting more difficult. But that's just the normal political stuff that happens in the world.
Ebbs and flows. Yeah.
Yeah. And we've seen this happen many times, where something not nice happens in a country, and all of a sudden, boom, you're out of business in that country, right? There's a coup or some other event, and by the stroke of a pen, boom, your business is shut down in that country. The other thing you got to think about is, are you going to get paid in your currency or the foreign country's currency? So the question is, do you want to be a currency trader here or not? And that's something you got to sort of think through as well. But anyway, it's an interesting topic for sure.
Yeah, we could do a whole episode on international ventures. That might be a fun topic down the road to tackle, because there's a lot there.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, Mike.
Cool. Yeah. Well, what do you think? Should we wrap it up?
I think so.
Great. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. We hope you found this episode interesting and thought-provoking like we did. If you have questions about what we discussed, please feel free to get in touch with us. Our email is bela.and.mike@gmail.com.
And please do subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. And even better yet, tell your friends about it and get them to listen. So until next time, signing off from upstate New York. See you soon, Mike.
Thanks, Bela. And from over here in Münster, Germany, I'll say bis bald, which is German for see you soon. Take care.